Welcome back to the Cory Doctorow podcast. I am not going to say Happy New Year because by my count, today is not January the 10th. It is clearly December the 41st, 2020, the year that will not end. I hope you had an amazing holiday. I had an amazing holiday. It was my first break, my first non-working day since March, December the 17th, the first day I took off. And I took off just over 2 weeks. And it was so badly needed. And I read in the hammock, and I went to our pool across the street and swam, and I did household chores, and I assembled fucking IKEA furniture. I did not buy the IKEA furniture. I will point out, as I have done before, that in a relationship where one party buys the flat pack and the other party assembles it, there is a moral hazard at work. I am living proof of that moral hazard, and I cooked a lot. If you've ever been tempted to do some grilling and you, like me, love your charcoal grill, I heartily recommend just getting a big-ass turkey breast, or even better yet, a turkey crown, which is the whole breast skin on, bone in, and you salt it and pepper it and leave it in the fridge on a rack uncovered for at least 24 hours. If it's got skin, you add a little baking soda when you salt and pepper it, and then you put it on a 325-degree grill, two-zone on the cool side, for half an hour, flip it after half an hour, and then just finish it up until the internal temperature is about 155, take it off the grill and cover it with a tea towel, let it rest for half an hour, and then carve and serve and make stock out of the bones. We had a couple of epically good turkey dinners. Your turkey leftovers should go into a turkey chili. It just doesn't get any better than that. We ate like royalty, and I also spent the holidays brewing. Well, this is the kind of hipster I am, brewing my own kombucha, but not just any kombucha, kombucha that is loaded with habaneros, ginger, and cardamom. Each gallon jar gets about a pound of ginger, two really hot habaneros, and a handful of cardamom pods, and steeps for 2 days before I strain it and bottle it. Let it go through that second fermentation to get nice and fizzy. And it is fiery and delicious and reminds me of the ginger beer I used to drink as a little boy in the Guyanese Trinidadian neighborhood I grew up in Toronto, where the shops would make their own ginger beer. And it's so good. Oh my God. So yeah, had a great break. We exchanged gifts. The best gift I got, my daughter wrote me a short story, and it is so good. My daughter Posey is going to be 13 in less than a month, which, if you've been following this podcast for a long time, this will come as a surprise to you, because it's been a long ass time that went by very, very quickly. And she wrote me and my wife each our own short stories, and they are, no fooling, objectively really fucking good. And she is embarrassed about them in ways that I kind of relate to from the days when I was writing and her age. And so I'm going to respect her wishes, not say anything about them beyond that they're very good. But against the day that she finally listens to this episode, if she ever does, Posey, those stories, we weren't just like playing it up to, you know, massage your feelings. You're a really good writer, kid. I'm just super proud. So speaking of writing, I got some stuff on the boil that gets into process, which is not a thing I talk about very often, in part because it always seems a little navel-gazy, but there are some occasions coming up that demand some process writing. So I'm working on a locus column now that talks about what it was like to fulfill the Kickstarter orders and what that says about the state of mobile ecosystems. It's become particularly salient in these last couple of days with the Parler deplatforming and Trump being kicked off, and what it means that so much power has been vested in so few hands. And I'm also, well, I'm coming up on the 20th anniversary of my first blog post, holy shit, in January, which is also the anniversary of the day I left Boing Boing, which was my 19th anniversary on Boing Boing, and quite nearly the anniversary of the founding of Pluralistic, which will come a few days later. And so I'm going to write some retrospectives around then. If you keep your eyes peeled on Pluralistic, you'll see those. And if you've been reading Pluralistic for this last year, thank you very much. I got back to work last Monday and got right back to work on The Lost Cause, my next novel, the post-Green New Deal Truth and Reconciliation with White Nationalist Militias novel. It's going well. It should be done, I would think, no later than the end of February. I'd be very surprised if the first draft took longer than that. And I'm thinking about doing a Patreon that would give just a small number of high dollar backers access to the raw pages as I revise them. I don't know if anyone would be interested in that, but I was thinking, you know, sort of 25 donors, and that would cover my mortgage while I rewrote the book and kind of make lemonade out of the lemons of the somewhat unpleasant chore of doing a rewrite, and also sort of keep me honest. But more on that as the situation develops. I also can announce that I am working on a new short story, and not just any short story. Joe Straczynski has asked me to write a story for The Last Dangerous Visions. If you know anything about science fiction history, you've probably heard of The Last Dangerous Visions, or at the very least read or heard of one of its predecessor volumes. Harlan Ellison edited these two volumes of New Age science fiction, not New Age, New Wave science fiction, I beg your pardon. Completely different thing. New Wave science fiction in the 60s that were quite daring at the time. In retrospect, they're kind of a mixed bag, but they featured the first publications of a number of really important writers. They broke some ground, and Harlan had always planned a third volume called The Last Dangerous Visions. And due to various reasons, most of them relating to his inability to follow through, he never got that book out. And when he died, Joe became his literary executor and decided to finish The Last Dangerous Visions and publish it. And he asked me if I would contribute a story, and I'm contributing a story once again about reconciliation, about truth and reconciliation. It's going to be a very personal story. Harlan was my hero when I was an adolescent, and he was my teacher when I went away to the Clarion Workshop. And he is the worst teacher I ever had. He was a terrible teacher in a way that goes beyond merely a mismatch and actually really goes into doing things that were actively harmful to people he had power and responsibility over. It went so badly that the director of the workshop was fired over it. Harlan was told that he could never teach Clarion again after that incident. So it was a pretty intense time. And then over the years that followed, Harlan and I locked horns a couple of times. He said some very unkind things about me in the press. We were on a panel once where he threatened to punch someone else on the panel in the face and called him a motherfucker. It was very fraught. And yet, when Harlan died, people came out to talk about the extraordinarily kind things that he had done. And that was the thing. Harlan did some extraordinarily kind things. Things that went above and beyond the kindnesses that we expect of people or that we're pleasantly surprised by. Things that were, by way of being something of a grand gesture and something of a sacrifice. And reconciling all of this is a tough project. And it involves coming to a way of understanding people where their good actions don't outweigh their bad actions, and their bad actions don't outweigh their good actions, and they just exist. You can't erase one with the other. This is a theme in my novel Attack Surface as well. So I'm going to write Joe a story about this, not about forgiveness, but about reconciliation. And it's going to be for Harlan, and it's going to go in The Last Dangerous Visions. And I plan on starting that story. Well, I'm recording this on Sunday. I think I'm going to start it tomorrow, Monday. It might be a couple of days in because it's a busy week, what with all the stuff going on. Well, some of that stuff is that on the 13th of January, I'm going to be speaking at the New Underscore Public conference that Eli Pariser is putting on. Pariser wrote a very influential column about the need for public spaces on the internet, not just spaces where the public can gather, but publicly owned spaces, spaces like parks. And we have a panel called What If the Future of Our Public Lives Online Looked Like Blank? Question mark. And that's going to be on the 13th of January. On the 22nd of January, I'm giving the keynote at linux.conf.au. This is a long-running national open source and free software conference in Australia. That's January the 22nd in the US, January the 23rd in Australia. That's the dateline for you. And on January the 25th, I will be William Gibson's interlocutor at the Strand's launch for the paperback edition of his novel Agency, which is a very, very good novel. And on the 22nd of February, I will be keynoting the NISO or NISO, I don't know how they say it, NISO Plus conference, which is an information security conference. And then the date isn't yet set, but I believe I can tell you that I will also be the interlocutor for the book launch event for Edward Snowden's memoir, which is coming out in a new young adult edition, a very, very good new young adult edition. And so I'll be interviewing Ed and hosting him in a live cast event sometime this month as well, or maybe next month. We're just pinning down a date now. So all of that is in the pipeline. And now I'm going to get to the reading. As you know, I have been reading my novel, Someone Comes to Town, Someone Leaves Town, into this podcast for quite some time now. We are on part 27 of this podcast. And, you know, judging by the scroll bar here, we are now, I'm going to say 80% of the way through this book. So we are really getting close to being done here. It's been quite a journey. It's been fun kind of experiencing who I was back when I wrote this novel, starting in 2002 or so, and finishing it in 2005 and publishing it in 2006. So it's cool. It's been great. And I hope you've enjoyed following along. I guess if you're still listening, you must have, because we're 27 parts in. Some of you have told me that you've been really enjoying it. Thank you for that kind feedback. So without further ado, here we go. Part 27 of Someone Comes to Town, Someone Leaves Town, the first podcast of 2021, or the last podcast of the extended mix of 2020. The mountain path had grown over with weeds and thistles and condoms and cans and inexplicable maxi pads and doll parts. She clung to his hand as he pushed through it, stepping in brackish puddles and tripping in sinkholes. He navigated the trail like a mountain goat, while Mimi lagged behind, tugging his arm every time she misstepped, jerking it painfully in its socket. He turned to her, ready to snap, "Keep the fuck up, would you?" and then swallowed his words. Her eyes were red-rimmed and scared, her full lips drawn down into a clown's frown, bracketed by deep lines worn by other moments of sorrow. He helped her beside him and turned his back on the mountain, faced the road and the town and the car with its trunk, with its corpse, with his brother. And he put an arm around her shoulders, a brotherly arm, and hugged her to him. "How you doing there?" he said, trying to make his voice light. Though it came out so leaden, the words nearly thudded in the wet dirt as they fell from his mouth. She looked into the dirt at their feet, and he took her chin and turned her face up so that she was looking into his eyes, and he kissed her forehead in a brotherly way, like an older brother coming home with a long-lost sister. "I used to want to know all the secrets," she said in the smallest voice. "I used to want to understand how the world worked. Little things like heavy stuff goes at the bottom of the laundry bag, or big things like the best way to get a boy to chase you is to ignore him, or medium things like if you cut an onion under running water, your eyes won't sting. If you wash your fingers afterwards with lemon juice, they won't stink. I used to want to know all the secrets, and every time I learned one, I felt like I'd taken a step on a journey to a place, a destination, to be the kind of person who knew all this stuff, the way everyone around me seemed to know all this stuff. I thought that once I learned enough secrets, I'd be like them. I don't want to learn secrets anymore, Andrew." She shrugged off his arm and took a faltering step down the slope, back towards the road. "I'll wait in the car, okay?" "Mimi," he said. He felt angry at her. How could she be so selfish as to have a crisis now, here, at this place that meant so much to him? "Mimi," he said, and swallowed his anger. His three brothers stayed on his sofa for a week, though they only left one wet towel on the floor, only left one sticky plate in the sink, one fingerprint smudged glass on the counter. He'd just opened his first business, the junk shop, not yet upscale enough to be called an antique shop, and he was pulling the long hours, known only to ER interns and entrepreneurs, showing up at 7 to do the books, opening at 10, working until 3, then turning things over to a minimum wage kid for 2 hours, while he drove to the city's thrift shops and picked for inventory, then working until 8 to catch the evening trade, then answering creditors and fighting with the landlord until 10, staggering to bed at 11 to sleep a few hours, before doing it all over again. So he gave them a set of keys and bought them a Metro Pass and stuffed an old wallet with $200 in 20s and wrote his phone number on the brim of a little pork pie hat that looked good on their head and turned them loose on the city. The shop had all the difficulties of any shop. snarky customers, shoplifting teenagers, breakage, idiots with jumpy dogs, never enough money, never enough time. He loved it. Every stinking minute of it. He'd never gone to bed happier and never woken up more full of energy in his life. He was in the world, finally, at last, until his brothers arrived. He took them to the store the first morning, showed them what he'd wrought with his own two hands, thought that he'd inspire them to see what they could do when they entered the world as well, after they'd gone home and grown up a little, which they would have to do very soon, as he reminded them at every chance, unmoved by George's hangdog expression at the thought. They'd walked around the shop slowly, picking things up, turning them over, having hilarious, embarrassing conversations about the likely purpose of an old Soloflex machine, a grubby pink Epilady leg razor, a Bakelite coffee carafe. The arguments went like this. George: look, it's a milk container. Ed: I don't think that's for milk. Fred: you should put it down before you drop it. It looks valuable. George: why don't you think it's for milk? Look at the silver inside. That's to reflect off the white milk and make it look, you know, cold and fresh. Fred: put it down. You're going to break it. George: fine, I'll put it down. But tell me, why don't you think it's for milk? Ed: because it's a thermos container, and that's to keep hot stuff hot, and it's got a screw top, and whatever it's made of looks like it'd take a hard knock without breaking. And so on, nattering at each other like cavemen puzzling over a Walkman, until Alan was called upon to settle the matter with an authoritative answer. It got so that he set his alarm for 4 a.m., so that he could sneak past their snoring form on the sofa and so avoid the awkward, desperate pleas to let them come with him into the shop and catch a free breakfast of poutine and eggs from the Harveys next door while they were at it. George had taken up coffee on his second day in the city, bugging the other two until they got him a cup, 6 or 7 cups a day, so that they flitted from place to place like a hummingbird, thrashed in their sleep, babbled when they spoke. It came to a head on the third night, when they dropped by the shop while he was on the phone and ducked into the back room in order to separate into threes again, with George wearing the pork pie hat even though it was a size too big for his head and hung down around his ears. Adam was talking to a woman who'd come into the shop that afternoon and greatly admired an institutional sofa from the mid-70s whose lines betrayed a pathetic, slavish devotion to Danish modern aesthetics. The woman had sat on the sofa, admired the sofa, walked around the sofa, hand trailing on its back, had been fascinated to see the provenance he'd turned up, an inventory sticker from the University of Toronto Maintenance Department, indicating that this sofa had originally been installed at the Robarts Library, itself of great and glorious aesthetic obsolescence. Here was Adam on the phone with this woman, closing a deal to turn a $3,000 profit on an item he'd acquired at the Goodwill As-Is Center for $5, and here were his brothers in the store, angry about something, shouting at each other about something. They ran around like three fat lunatics, reeking of the BO that they exuded like the ass end of a cow, loud, boorish, and indescribably weird. Weird beyond the quaint weirdness of his little curiosity shop. Weird beyond the interesting weirdness of the punks and the goths and the mods who were wearing their subcultures like political affiliations as they strolled by the shop. Those were redeemable weirds. Weirds within the bounds of normal human endeavor. His brothers, on the other hand, were utterly irredeemable. He sank down behind the counter as George said something to Fred in their own little shorthand language, a combination of grunts and nonsense syllables that the three had spoken together for so long that he'd not even noticed it, until they were taken out of their context and put into his. He put his back against the wall and brought his knees to his chest and tried to sound like he had a belly button as he said to the lady, "Yes, absolutely, I can have this delivered tomorrow if you'd like to courier over a check." This check? It was enough to keep his business afloat for another 30 days, to pay his rent, and pay the minimum wage kid, and buy his groceries. And here were his brothers, and now Ed was barking like a dog, a rare moment of mirth from him who had been the sober outer bark since he was a child and rarely acted like the 17-year-old he was behaving like today. "Is everything all right?" she said down the phone, this woman who had been smartly turned out in a cashmere sweater and a check scarf and a pair of bootcut jeans that looked new and good over her designer shoes with little heels. They'd flirted a little, even though she was at least 10 years older than him, because flirting was a new thing for Alan, and he discovered he wasn't bad at it. "Everything is fine," he said. "Just some goofballs out in the street out front. How about if I drop off the sofa for 6 o'clock? "Killed her! Cut her up! Sliced her open!" George screeched suddenly, skidding around the counter, rolling past him, yanking the phone out of the wall. And in that moment, he realized what the sounds they'd been making in their private speech had been. They had been a reenactment, a grunting, squeaking playback of the day, the fateful day, the day he'd taken his knife and done his mischief with it. He reached for the phone cable and plugged it back into the wall, but it was as though his hand were moving of its own accord, because his attention was focused elsewhere on the three of them arrayed in a triangle, as they had been on the hillside, as they had been when they had chanted at him, when the knife grip was sure in the palm of his hands. The ritual, that's what it was. It was a ritual. The ritual had the feel of something worn smooth with countless repetitions. He found himself rigid with shock, offended to his bones. This was what they did now, in the cave, with Davy sitting atop their mother, black and shriveled. This was how they behaved, running through this enactment of his great shame of the day Danny died. No wonder Daryl had terrorized them out of their home. They were beyond odd and eccentric. They were unfit. Unfit for polite company, for human society. The phone in his hand rang. It was the woman. "You know, I'm thinking that maybe I should come back in with a tape measure and measure up the sofa before I commit to it. It's a lot of money, and to be honest, I just don't know if I have room." "What if I measure it for you? I could measure it for you and call you back with the numbers." The three brothers stared at him with identical, glassy, alien stares. "That's okay. I can come in." And he knew that she meant, "I won't ever come in again." "What if I bring it by anyway? I could bring it by tomorrow night and you could see it and make up your mind. No obligation." "That's very kind of you, but I'm afraid that I'll be out tomorrow evening. Friday? I could come by Friday." He was trying to remember how to flirt now, but he couldn't. "I could come by and we could have a glass of wine or something." And he knew that he'd said exactly the wrong thing. "It's all right," she said coldly. "I'll come by later in the week to have another look. I have to go now. My husband is home." And he was pretty sure she wasn't married, but he said goodbye and hung up the phone. He looked at his solemn brothers now, and they looked at him. "When are you going home?" he said, and Edward looked satisfied, and Fred looked a little disappointed, and George looked like he wanted to throw himself in front of a subway. And his bottom lip began to tremble. "It was Ed's game," he said. "The Davy game, it was his." He pointed a finger. "You know, I'm not like them. I can be of my own. I'm what they need, but they're not what I need." The other two stared at their fat bellies in the direction of their fat feet. Andrew had never heard George say this, had never even suspected that this thought lurked in his heart. But now that it was out on the table, it seemed like a pretty obvious fact to have taken note of. All things being equal, things weren't equal. He was cold and numb. "That's a really terrible thing to say, George," is what he said. "That's easy for you to say," is what George said. "You are here. You are in the world. It's easy for you to say that we should be happy with things the way that they are." George turned on his heel and put his head down and bowled out the door, slamming it behind him so that the mail slot rattled and the glass shook and a stack of nice melamine cafeteria trays fell off a shelf and clattered to the ground. He didn't come back that night. He didn't come back the next day. Ed and Fred held their grumbling tummies and chewed at the insides of their plump cheeks and sat on the unsold Danish modern sofa in the shop and freaked out the few customers who drifted in and then drifted out. "This is worse than the last time," Ed said, licking his lips and staring at the donut that Albert refused to feel guilty about eating in front of them. Last time, he said, not missing Felix's quick warning glare at Ed, even though Ed appeared to. He went away for a whole day, just disappeared into town. When he came back, he said that he needed some time away, that he'd had an amazing day on his own, that he wanted to come and see you, and that he'd do it whether we wanted to come or not. Ah, Alvin said, understanding then how the three had come to be staying with him. He wondered how long they'd last without the middle, without the ability to eat. He remembered holding the infant Eddie in his arms, the boy light and hollowed out. He remembered holding the three boys at once, heavy as a bowling ball. Ah, he said. I have to have a word with him. When Greg came home, Alan was waiting for him, sitting on the sofa, holding his head with one hand. Eli and Fred snored uneasily in his bed, breathing heavily through their noses. Hey, he said as he came through the door, scuffing at the lock with his key for a minute or two first. He was rumpled and dirty, streaked with grime on his jawline and hair hanging limp and greasy over his forehead. Greg, Alan said, nodding, straightening out his spine, listening to it pop. I'm back, George said, looking down at his sneakers, which squished with gray water that oozed over his carpet. Alan didn't say anything, just sat pat and waited, the way he sometimes did when con artists came into the shop with some kind of scam that they wanted him to play along with. It worked the same with George. After a hard stare at his shoes, he shook his head and began to defend himself, revealing the things that he knew were indefensible. I had to do it. I just had to. I couldn't live in that cave with that thing anymore. I couldn't live inside those two anymore. I'm going crazy. There's a whole world out here, and every day I get farther away from it. I get weirder. I just wanted to be normal. I just wanted to be like you. They stopped letting me into the clubs after I ran out of money, and they kicked me out of the cafes. I tried to ride the subway all night, but they threw me off at the end of the line, so I ended up digging a transfer out of the trash can and taking an all-night bus back downtown. No one looked at me twice that whole time, except to make sure that I was gone. I walked back here from Eglinton. That was 5 miles away, a good 40-minute walk in the night, and the cold, and the dark. Greg pried off his sneakers with his toes and then pulled off his gray, squelching socks. I couldn't find anyone who'd let me use the toilet, he said, and Alan saw the stain on his pants. He stood up and took Greg by the cold hand, as he had when they were both boys, and said, It's all right, Gord. I'll get you cleaned up and changed and put you to bed, okay? Just put your stuff in the hamper in the bathroom, and I'll find you a change of clothes and make a couple of sandwiches, all right? And just as easy as that, George's spirit was tamed. He came out of the shower pink and steaming and scrubbed, put on the sweats that Adam found for him in an old gym bag, ate his sandwiches, and climbed into Adam's bed with his brothers. When he saw them again next, they were reassembled and downcast, though they ate the instant oatmeal with raisins and cream that he set out for them with gusto. I think a bus ticket home is about $40, right? Alan said, as he poured himself a coffee. They looked up at him. Ed's eyes were grateful. His lips clamped shut. And you'll need some food on the road. Another $50 or $60, okay? Ed nodded, and Adam set down a brown $100 bill, and then put a purple 10 on top of it. For the taxi to the Greyhound station, he added. They finished their oatmeal in silence, while Adam puttered around the apartment, stripping the cheese-smelling sheets and oily pillowcases off his bed, rinsing the hairs off the soap, cleaning the toilet, erasing the signs of their stay. Well, he said at length, I should get going to the shop. Yeah, Ed said in George's voice, and it cracked before he could close his lips again. Right, Adam said. Well, they patted their mouth and ran stubby fingers through their lank hair, already thinning, though they were still in their teens. They stood and cracked their knuckles against the table. They patted their pockets absently, then pocketed the 100 and the 10. Well, Adam said. They left, turning to give him the keys he'd had cut for them, a gesture that left him feeling obscurely embarrassed and mean-spirited, even though, he told himself, he'd put them up and put up with them very patiently indeed. And then he left and locked the door with his spare keys. Useless spare keys. No one would ever come to stay with him again. What I found in the cave, he said, lying in the grass on the hillside, breathing hard, the taste of vomit sour in his mouth, his arms and legs sore from the pumping run down the hillside. What I found in the cave, he said, and she held his hand nervously, her fingers not sure of how hard to squeeze, whether to caress. What I found in the cave, he said, and was glad she hadn't come with him, hadn't been there for what he'd seen and heard. What I found in the cave was the body of my first girlfriend. Her skeleton polished to a gleam and laid out carefully on the floor. Her red hair in a long plait, brushed out in brittle, circled her small skull like a halo. He'd laid her out before my mother and placed her fingernails at the exact tips of her finger bones. The floor was dirty and littered with rags and trash. It was dark and it stank of shit. There were piles of shit here and there. The places where my brothers had slept had been torn apart. My brother Bradley, his nook was caved in. I moved some of the rocks, but I didn't find him under there. Benny was gone. Craig was gone. Ed, Frankie, and George were gone. Even Davy was gone. All the parts of the cave that made it home were gone. Except for my mother, who was rusted and sat askew on the uneven floor. One of her feet had rusted through, and her generator had run dry, and she was silent and dry, with a hummus paste of leaves and guano and gunk sliming her basket. I went down to the cave where my father spoke to us, and I found that I found that I couldn't see in the dark anymore. I'd never had a moment's pause in the halls of my father, but now I walk falteringly, the sounds of my footsteps not like the steps of a son of the mountain at all. I heard them echo back, and they sounded like an outsider, and I fell twice and hurt my head here. He touched the goose egg he'd raised on his forehead. And I got dizzy. And then I was in the pool, but it didn't sound right, and I couldn't hear it right, and I got my clothes off, and then I stood there with them in my arms. His hand came back bloody, and he wiped it absently on the grass, and Mimi took hold of it. Because if I put them down, it was dark. And I never find them again. So I bundled them all up and carried them over my head, and I waded in, and the water had never been so cold, and it never felt so oily. And there was a smell to it, a stagnant smell. I waded out, and I stood, and I shivered, and I whispered, "Father?" And I listened. I heard the sound of the water I'd disturbed, lapping around my ears and up onto the shore. I smelled the sewage and oil smell, but none of the habitual smells of my father. Clean water, coal face, sulfur, grass, and lime. I picked my way out of the water again, and I walked to the shore, and it was too dark to put on my clothes, so I carried them under one arm and felt my way back to the summer cave and leaned against my mother and waited to drip dry. I'd stepped in something soft that squished and smelled between my mother and my father, and I didn't want to put on my socks until I'd wiped it off, but I couldn't bring myself to wipe it on the cave floor. Marcy's eye sockets looked up at the ceiling. She'd been laid out with so much care. I couldn't believe that Davy had had anything to do with it. I thought that Benny must be around somewhere, looking in, taking care. I closed my eyes so that I wasn't looking into the terrible, recriminating stare, and I leaned my head up against my mother, and I breathed until the stink got to me. And then I pried myself upright and walked out of the cave. I stopped and stood in the mouth of the cave and listened as hard as I could, but my father wasn't speaking. and the smell was getting to me. She got him dressed, and she fed him sips of water, and she got him standing and walked him in circles around the little paddock he'd collapsed in. "I need to get Georgie out of the car," he said. "I'm going to leave him in the cave. It's right." She bit her lip and nodded slowly. "I can help you with that," she said. "I don't need help," he said lamely. "I didn't say you did, but I can help anyway." They walked down slowly, him leaning on her arm like an old man, steps faltering in the scree on the slope. They came to the road and stood before the trunk as the cars whizzed past them. He opened the trunk and looked down. The journey hadn't been good to Greg. He'd come undone from his winding sheet and lay face down, neck stiff, his nose mashed against the floor of the trunk. His skin had started to flake off, leaving a kind of scale or dandruff on the flat industrial upholstery inside the trunk. Alan gingerly tugged loose the sheet and began, awkwardly, to wrap it around his brother, ignoring the grit of shed skin and hair that clung to his fingers. Mimi shook him by the shoulder hard, and he realized she'd been shaking him for some time. "You can't do that here," she said. "Would you listen to me? You can't do that here. Someone will see." She held something up, his keys. "I'll back it up to the trailhead," she said. "Close the trunk and wait for me there." She got behind the wheel and he sloped off to the trailhead and stood numbly, holding the lump on his forehead and staring at a rusted Coke can in a muddy puddle. She backed the car up almost to his shins, put it in park, and came around to the trunk. She popped the lid and looked in and wrinkled her nose. "Okay," she said. "I'll get him covered, and we'll carry him up the hill." "Mimi," he began. "Mimi, it's okay. You don't need to go in there for me. I know it's hard for you." She squeezed his hand. "I'm over it, Andy. Now that I know what's up there, it's not scary any longer." He watched her shoulders work, watched her wings work, as she wrapped up his brother. When she was done, he took one end of the bundle and hoisted it, trying to ignore the rain of skin and hair that shook off over the bumper and his trousers. "Up we go," she said, and moved to take the front. "Tell me when to turn." They had to set him down twice before they made it all the way up the hill. The first time, they just stood in silence, wiping their cramped hands on their thighs. The second time, she came to him and put her arm around his shoulders and gave him a soft kiss on the cheek that felt like a feather. "Almost there," she said. He nodded and bent to pick up his end. Mimi plunged through the cave mouth without a moment's hesitation, and they set him down just inside the entrance, near a pair of stained cotton Y-fronts. Alan waited for his heart to stop thudding and the sweat to cool on his brow, and then he kicked the underwear away as an afterthought. "God," he said. She moved to him, put her arm around his shoulder. "You're being brave," she said. "God," he said again. "Let it out, you know, if you want to." But he didn't. He wanted to sit down. He moved to his mother's side and leaned against her. Mimi sat on her hunkers before him and took his hand and tried to tilt his chin up with one finger, but he resisted her pull, and she rose and began to explore the cave. He heard her stop near Marcy's skeleton for a long while, then move some more. She circled him and his mother, then opened her lid and stared into the hamper. He wanted to tell her not to touch his mother, but the words sounded ridiculous in his head, and he didn't dare find out how stupid they sounded, moving through free space. And then the washing machine bucked and made a snapping sound and hummed to life. "The generator's dead," he thought, "and she's all rusted through," and still the washing machine moved. He heard the gush of water filling her, a wet and muddy sound. "What did you do?" he asked. He climbed slowly to his feet, facing away from his mother, not wanting to see her terrible bucking as she wobbled on her broken foot. "Nothing," Mimi said. "I just looked inside and it started up." He stared at his mother, enraptured, mesmerized. Mimi stole alongside of him, and he noticed that she'd taken off her jacket and the sweatshirt, splaying out her wings around her. Her hand found his and squeezed. The machine rocked. His mother rocked and gurgled and rushed, and then she found some local point of stability and settled into a soft, rocking rhythm. The rush of water echoed off the cave walls, a white noise shushing that sounded like skis cutting through powder. It was a beautiful sound, one that transported him to a million mornings spent waiting for the boys' laundry to finish and be hung on the line. All gone. He jerked his head up so fast that something in his neck cracked, needling pain up into his temples and forehead. He looked at Mimi, but she gave no sign of having heard the voice, the words, all gone, all gone. Mimi looked at him and cocked her head. What? She said. He touched her lips with a finger, forgetting to be mindful of the swelling there, and she flinched away. There was a rustle of wings and clothing. My son's, oh, my son's gone. The voice emerged from that white noise roar of water humming and sloshing back and forth in her basket. Mimi squeezed his hand so hard, he felt the bones grate. Mom, he said softly, his voice cracking. He took half a step toward the washer. So tired. I'm worn out. I've been worn out. He touched the enamel on the lid of the washer and felt the vibrations through his fingertips. I can take you home, he said. I'll take care of you in the city. Too late. There was a snapping sound, and then a front corner of the machine settled heavily. One rusted-out foot, broken clean off, rolled across the cave floor. The water sounds stilled. Mimi breathed some words, something like, oh my God, but maybe in another language, or maybe he'd just forgotten his own tongue. I need to go, he said. Whoa. All right, then. Thank you very much for that extended edition. Yeah, stay safe out there. You know it as I do. There's a new strain in town. It's ugly. It's contagious. It's got me worried as hell. It should worry you, too. If you were taking precautions before, take more precautions. If you weren't taking precautions before, take precautions. We are in this together until the idiots in charge get the vaccines in our arms. God help us all, and I'll talk to you next week.
You've been listening to the Cory Doctorow Podcast, licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Sharealike US 3.0. Or as Woody Guthrie put it in another context, this song is copyrighted in the US under Seal of Copyright 154085 for a period of 28 years, and anyone caught singing it without our permission will be a mighty good friend of ourn, because we don't give a dern. Publish it, write it, sing it, swing to it, yodel it, we wrote it, that's all we wanted to do. Many thanks to John Taylor Williams for mastering. That's Ryneck Studio, W-R-Y-N-E-C-K Studio, at gmail.com. John Taylor Williams is a full-time self-employed audio engineer, producer, composer, and sound designer. In his free time, he makes beer, jewelry, odd musical instruments, and furniture. He likes to meditate, to read, and to cook. Talk to you next week.